Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Hello, Urncasters. Welcome to the Bugle Ashes Urncast, and I, Andy Zaltzman, bring you glad tidings from the land of the unnecessarily revived mullet, Australia. It's not going to be 5-0. That is the greatest thing that's happened in at least the last 2 years in the world. England will not lose the Ashes 5-0. It might not even be 4-0, although it almost certainly will be. But it definitely won't be 5-0. Break out the champagne. Anyone listening in England, or well, maybe a bottle of cheap lemonade would be more appropriate. But still, break it out. England's supremely intricate long-form strategic master plan has borne fruit. Is it fruit, or is it a squirrel dropping that looks like a grape? Who gives a shit? It's worked. Because, finally, three and a half tests into the series, England have baked complacency so deep into the Australian team that they failed to win at the SCG by being bowled out for 68 in Melbourne, then slumping to 36 for 4 after conceding another 400 declared first innings. England had Australia exactly where they wanted them. And as a result, they roared back into a state of marginally reduced bethrashedness by clinging on for a draw after being thoroughly outplayed yet again for most of the largely one-sided and slightly rain-shortened Sydney Test. But the point is, we have in effect thrashed Australia by not being thrashed 5-0, and in relative terms, that is an absolute shooing. Felicity Ward joining me, as always, for the Australiac perspective. It's a very, very dark day for Australia, the fact that the now traditional 5-0 humping has been slightly reduced.
Did you say humping?
I did say humping, yes. I believe that's the technical term.
I think I heard you blush when you say it. Humping. Oh, I'm going to say something naughty. I don't know. Andy, I'm absolutely delighted, mate.
Right.
It was almost like watching Test cricket. 5 days.
Yes.
5 days. And it turns out England, real 5-day specialists at not being thrashed.
Yes.
If they could make it to 5 days every time, you might have been in with a chance.
Yeah. In Melbourne, I guess it was just the fact that they missed out day, 2.5 and 4. So day five, England's strength on day five, where Australia have traditionally floundered. Didn't really come into play. So.
Oh, look, I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it.
See, this really upsets emotional. This upsets me, Felicity.
Because
had so little to cling to. We wanted Australia to be at least slightly disappointed. Even the players at the end, you could tell they'd already won the series. They were a little bit pissed off they hadn't won. But there were no, players slumping to the ground in desolation. It really devalued England's achievement for me. I want to see tears and pain.
Yeah, there was no face in hands. I'm sorry. Yep. There was no, consolation hugs. There was no, no one was having to reassure some of the younger players that it was going to be okay. And I am sorry for that. I am truly, genuinely sorry for that.
Do you know what it was like, Felicity?
Hit me.
It was like watching f***ing New Zealand. Yeah, when New Zealand lost the World Cup final, they all just said, it's just been nice to have a day out. F*** sake. You want to see players devastated by their failure. And Australia have let everyone down.
Look, we'll discuss this with our guest.
Yep.
But when Bairstow got that century, I genuinely welled up. Just watching him metaphorically headbutt his way back into the series. It's emotional.
He got in the last over of the day on the third day. And his celebration, he sort of ran 3/4 of the way to the pavilion, shouting.
Yeah.
And you could sort of see that everyone else sort of peering at him from about 50 yards away. He was still on the pitch thinking, well, he seems to be enjoying himself.
Joe Root holding up a sign going, turn around, you're not finished yet.
20 matches he's played since his last Test 100, which he'd not even reached 60, let alone 100. I mean, if humans had evolved with four digits instead of five and had therefore counted in base eight, so essentially 64 would have been a century, he still wouldn't have scored a century for 19 consecutive tests. So you can see why he got so excited. But it all seemed to help. England had been in, you know, it had been just a typically disastrous first couple of days. But in the end, you know, Bairstow and Stokes turned it around a bit, and then they still didn't do very well with the ball in the second innings. They nearly tanked it on the final day. But it was, and I mean this very sincerely, Felicity, it was the greatest moment for the England men's test team in Australia in the past 11 years. Now, I mean, that is, I mean, not so much a low bar as a subterranean bar. I mean, that is, you have to burrow down to get under that bar. But somehow, despite the deep philosophical non-negotiable belief of England cricket in the inevitability of losing 5-0 when we go to Australia these days, they found a way to not lose. It was one of the great not losses in recent Ashes history. It was straight into the top two greatest results for England in Australia in the last 10 years. And, you know, you can't say fairer than that.
I can't take that away from you, Andy. Yep. I cannot take that away from you.
To discuss this further, we are now joined for the first time on the Bugle Ashes Urncast by, well, I don't quite know how to describe our guest. She does so many different things, broadcaster, writer, lawyer, former cricketer, former captain of Middlesex. Please welcome to the Urncast, Isabel Westbury. Izzy, have I missed anything off your varied CV? Anything else you want to chuck in there, true or otherwise?
Honorary Australian after this summer. I'm going to say honorary Australian.
Honorary Australian, although that's, I don't know if that's an accolade or not.
But, how dare you? Absolutely, how dare you?
Survivor of Tour Down Under. Right. We haven't even finished it yet, but I feel like I'm going to earn that one.
Yes. Mm. As a member of the sort of English press contingent, there is an element of, it does feel almost like a physical battering of the soul watching England getting thrashed in Australia.
Oh, yeah. But on the flip side, it also feels like a rite of passage, as it's happened so often. Mm. I mean, this is my first Ashes tour working with the English press, and so I've got the kind of giddy excitement of just being here. I mean, to be honest, being let into this damn country in the first place was a sort of a feat of engineering in itself. Better than Novak, or he might have finally made it. But I felt quite proud of that. It was easier for me to get into here than Novak Djokovic, so that's always a plus. Yeah, I've got this giddy excitement still. So, and because I've seen so many from dark, rain-inflicted, you know, awful January in England, of England getting battered 5-0. It kind of felt as though it didn't really matter as long as I was watching it in the sunshine and daylight, which is pretty much what it's turned out to be.
So you've been commentating on Triple M Radio, Australian radio station. Yeah, how has it been being, you know, the English voice in an Australian team?
I feel as though this needs to be put into context for any English listeners.
Please.
I mean, it really had to be explained a few times to me before I sort of signed the dotted line. First of all, Triple M is a rock show. It plays rock music, and then now and again it just decides, instead of rock, it wants to play Australia's Battering the Poms. Genuinely, it doesn't cover any other cricket apart from the Ashes, so it's just a routine, England gonna come here, we're gonna win 5 or 4-0, whatever it is, let's have some fun. And then they go, oh shit, we probably need a pom. And I'm not even kidding, in that because of the COVID restrictions right now, the only way in which you can get into the country, you probably all know this from following the Novak saga, is that you need to have not only a visa, I mean that's easy these days, is you need to have an exemption. And for the exemption, you need to demonstrate that you have a critical skill. So I have literally got a letter which says that I am a core part of Australian culture that no Australian could otherwise fulfill. And it's true, because no Australian could be the pom sort of battering ram that needs to just bat away Merv Hughes jumping all over the place and Mark Taylor, who's beaten England more times than I've scored a run. I mean, this is my core service to the inherent culture of Australia, is just to sit there and take it.
Right.
But look, one thing you have not done is sat there and take it. if anyone hasn't listened to Izzy, please listen to Triple M. I have no allegiance to any radio station to whom you listen to about, for the cricket. But listening to very lackadaisical ex-players mumble their way through some slight observations of the day, but usually just some old stories. And then Izzy on her feet with this plum English accent, enunciating every consonant, syllable, vowel that's ever been invented for every, and with the passion of someone who's winning.
Isn't that just so awful, though?
No, it's extraordinary to listen to. And I say this as, like, I am a new massive fan, and it is very hard as a woman to win anyone over in sport. If you're a woman in sport, in any part, it's hard to win a male audience over. And I look at the Twitter commentary under clips and everyone's like, you've reinvigorated the game. Welcome to Australia anytime. Like, it is a joy listening to you commentate. I've been looking up YouTube clips for Triple M. Do you know how desperate that is?
Oh, you don't want to know what you'll find if you just look up YouTube clips of Triple M.
Oh, my darling, I've lived there since 1980. I think I've been on their show before, but it's been absolutely marvellous, and it is such a contrast of energies and tempos and just the way that you describe the game. I don't know, this has just turned into a bit of a fangirl moment, but I have loved it, especially watching the machismo of the Triple M commentary team just being like injected with this strong female English voice is delightful.
I had rather, while it could have turned it out to be a very awkward moment in the first test, when I was talking about Joe Root, is the one man that seems to be able to hold a bat in Australia, which is, or Englishman that seems to be able to hold a bat. And he had a really wonderful year last year. I think he scored 6 or 7 centuries. Mm. It was ridiculous. He scored more runs than anybody else put together in the England team. And so I didn't do Latin or anything at school, but there were a few phrases that kind of get thrown around the ether that you just know, you know, like carpe diem, that kind of thing. And so I said, just off the bat, that he had an annus mirabilis. Now, I don't think you even need to know Latin to probably work out what on earth that means. I mean, you need to know the Queen's speech to know what an annus horribilis is, right? The looks that I got when I said that made me second guess my whole primary school education in 1 second. And the worst thing is, and I mean, I have really tried to embrace some of the Australian dialect, for example, because it's a commercial radio show, that we need to flog something called Wagner's vitamins, which actually, as I understand it, are Wagner's vitamins, but apparently not.
What do they do? Do they put your ring through a cycle?
Oh, you wouldn't believe it. Callum Ferguson, he tried to repeat annus mirabilis, but of course, being Australian, he went, ah, is it an inus? An inus mirabilis? I was like, oh, no. No, please stop now.
Izzy, the overestimation you have of the Australian education system is quite amazing. That phrase has never been uttered by any teacher at any school apart from private schools in Sydney, maybe.
Personally, I think there needs to be more Latin in cricket commentary generally. And yeah,
obviously.
It's sad to get the kids involved in it again. In fact, all T20 commentary should be in Latin, I would say.
Yeah. We'll do different dead language per year.
Yeah, T20 needs to be freshened up because people get bored of it. So
yeah, that's right.
Some Latin involved.
The 100 in ancient Greek.
Church attendance probably has the same trajectory as cricket match attendance over the last decade, to be fair. Yeah.
Where would you say this game ranks in England's greatest face-saving, rain-affected, almost it up anyway, escapes with a draw?
I think it's quite appropriate that we should celebrate more than any victory a non-defeat, essentially.
Yes.
So I would almost even argue that it ranks above some of our greatest victories, like Headingley 2019, because, hey, what are we good at? Not losing in Australia, frankly.
It is so rare for England not to lose these days. So I mentioned before, this is the fifth series out of the last six that England's been 3-0 down after three. So, I mean, even draws have become increasingly rare. And in terms of what made it possible, England ended up with their numbers 5, 6 and 7, Stokes, Bairstow and Butler, all carrying injuries. And that seemed to be what finally galvanised England into action. Stokes pulled his side bowling and Butler busted his finger wicket-keeping and Bairstow got hit on the hand batting. And England's performance seemed to be boosted. I mean, is this going to be the new strategy, kind of escape-to-victory style inflictings of injuries on players?
Or the prospect of heading back home on the next flight. I mean, I think you'll find that they'll be galvanised come the final test in Hobart because they know that they're getting out of this. And I say hellhole in the nicest possible way. Hellhole because their record is so utterly terrible.
It's an emotional hellscape.
Absolutely. A number of times I've been told that the Ashes should move permanently to England because that's the only place that it's competitive. It's becoming a thing.
Joe Root, we talked about, he looks just totally and utterly exhausted. I don't know the total number of nut shots he's taken now. He had another one in this game that didn't just hit him in the nuts. It left a kind of red mark on his trousers as if to to just prove exactly where it had hit him. I mean, at this point, he might as well just walk out to the middle at the start of his innings, just ceremonially whack himself in the bluters with a mallet and say, can we all just play some normal cricket now without you firing a missile into my Murgatroyds at 90 miles an hour?
Zoltz, you know these days how they've got really good sort of techie stuff that show you exactly where the ball's landed and yes. They can do it with a flurry of like the last six overs, this many balls hit this spot on the pitch. They started doing it before Joe Root's box. How many? It's actually uncanny to the point that yesterday, I mean, obviously, I'm one of the very, very few people in the Witten press box who isn't a bloke and therefore is not sort of constantly in jeopardy of something hitting that area and being in apparently mortal pain. So I just turned around and went, I mean, it does, is it a problem with technique? This poor man keeps on getting his nuts in the way, or is it the fact that he's willing to sacrifice them? And how much pain does a man have to go through in order to sacrifice that over getting out? These are the questions that are now circulating around Joe Root's groin area. It was referred to as the abdomen area.
Yes,
on the first time it occurred.
His undercarriage.
Yes, anterior abdomen. I think we can call it.
For those familiar with cricket, or at least the lead up to the Ashes, will know that Australia were without a test captain, I think 2 weeks before the start, due to his own indiscretion in the abdominal region involving camera phones and another lady. So the best take that I've seen is that we didn't think that another test captain's genitals would generate as much discussion as poor Tim Payne, said Australian captain this summer. But Joe Root is giving it a good go.
Yes. In a much
and just
more
as
noble
much
manner.
Coverage.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. Publicly, not behind the secrecy of his own bedroom, in front of everyone to witness.
Yes. And I guess what the two have in common is their partners are probably equally upset by what's been going on. Root shot in the first innings, out seventh ball for a duck to Scott Boland. I mean, he looked so tired when he played that shot after all the strain of captaining another losing team in Australia. I think by the time the ball reached slip, he'd actually just laid down and fallen asleep at the crease. And by the time it was caught, he was already having a nightmare about being told that his top three for the next test would be Liz Hurley, Dougal from the Magic Roundabout and a bucket of eels. I can't remember seeing a more fatigued shot, in particularly the first innings of a test. What kind of level of sympathy, Felicity, do you have for Root and his predicament?
I mean, when he nicked the ball in the second innings, I think I actually saw him whisper mummy. He looked so sad, like red eyeballs and bags down to his lips. I almost wanted to go out and go, guys, can we just give him another go? He's just tired. He's had a really... It's the new year. Come on, new year, new rules. Come on, Joe. No, you know when when a kid's having a really bad run and the mum comes out and goes, come on, guys, we're a team. let's do it again. Let's give him another chance. And everyone goes, yay.
That's sort of what's been happening with Hasib Hamid, I think. They keep dropping him for nothing, and then he keeps getting out straight away anyway. So.
Also, surely with Joe Root, though, the poor man, is that the one thing he didn't want was a new year, because the only thing he really had to cling on to going into the, I don't know, the second test in Melbourne was that he'd had such a ridiculous 2021. And now he's got the wonderful accolade of having registered England's first duck of 2022.
I mean, last year was a real annus mirabilis, wasn't it?
Some people might say. Some people might say.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There were some sort of unexpected successes in this match. We mentioned Bairstow earlier on, who celebrates with enormous kind of pent-up emotion, Izzy. I mean, his previous century, which was, in layman's terms, a f*** of a long time ago, late in 2018, as I said.
Is that Latin as well?
Played 19 tests.
Yeah.
It is Latin, yes. Sorry, Felicity. 19 tests in between that 100 and this one. And in Sri Lanka, when he scored that 100, I remember him sort of gesticulating to the press box, saying, there, you know, you guys are wrong. I mean, in those 19 tests of largely failure, he's not gone to the press box ever and said, yeah, you guys have got a point. But it was a great moment for someone who's really, you know, if he'd never played test cricket again, he'd been given enough chances, but he's come back and, you know, it was quite an extraordinary personal triumph, don't you think?
It was. The problem that I've got is somebody a few weeks ago said that he looks like, when he's celebrating, like an angry Henry VIII. And I can't unsee it. I cannot unsee it.
Yeah.
So every time, because he does that, he gets very emotional. Like, fair play to him. I mean, none of us know what it's like to score a test century. I'm sure it's a wonderful thing. But he sort of, he roars. It's like both arms come and it's sort of vein popping stuff. And all I can see is sort of Henry VIII having a go at his sixth wife.
Yeah. He was good at the pull and the cup, Henry VIII, in different ways. I guess that's the way he dealt with women.
I mean, the other problem with Johnny Bairstow celebrating, especially on Jane McGrath Day, is everything is fluorescent pink, which is also, coincidentally, the natural skin tone of his face.
Yeah, and there are an inordinately high proportion of ginger men in England's men's test. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, Zoltz.
Yeah, it's great to see. Well, I mean, it's a source of huge pride in the ginger community.
Andy, speaking of that, we both did a show called The Crickets On last week, and you had a pre-recorded package and I was doing the live record.
Yep.
And it cut back to Miles Jupp and he said, reminds me of Baz Luhrmann's song, Everyone Wears Sunscreen. And I really enjoyed that.
Usman Khawaja recalled for this test. He's had a very mixed career, particularly against England. He's failed in England, essentially. Scored a big 100 at the SCG, but in the final test last time. But this was an amazing personal triumph for him. He had two centuries in the match. This was my favourite stat of the match, by the way. Ben Stokes batting at five, scored 50 in both innings for England. Khawaja batting at five, scored hundreds in both innings. It's the second test in history, and there have been nearly 2,500 of them, in which the number five scored at least 50 in all four innings. The second
what?
ever.
Second ever?
The second ever. The other was the timeless test in Durban in 1939 when England famously, a game that lasted from the 3rd of March to the 14th of March with a couple of rest days. They then had to leave to get the boat back home and the game was drawn anyway after nearly two f***ing weeks. Isn't cricket great? That was the only other test in which the number five scored 50s in all four innings. And I searched it, was on air with Tim, so I found myself punching the air with delight, which I think means that I've wasted my life. But anyway, Khawaja, back in the team after 2 years out, two silken centuries. He's a beautiful, elegant stroke maker. And age 35, his wife and his young kid were in the crowd. It was, and he, you know, he grew up in Sydney, I think. So it was... I mean, that was, there have been some good personal stories in this
Beautiful.
Game. Yeah.
You offered far too sober a stat on Uzi. My favourite one was that when he got to about halfway through his second century and suddenly people started realising that in two innings he'd scored more than about five or six English batters put together. Yes. And the worst thing was he only had to score, like, I don't know, five more runs before you added the next English batter. So by the time that he completed his two innings and twin centuries, he'd scored pretty much more than the entire English team cumulatively, bar Root. So that stat to me is much more exciting.
Is he sort of commentating with the Australians on Triple M? How have they reacted to Boland's success? Because, I mean, no one... He wasn't even in the squad. He was basically called up as a COVID cover during the Brisbane test. No one really kind of saw him as a test bowler. Now he's had the third best start to a test career in history in terms of bowlers who've taken 10 or more wickets in their first two tests. His average is bettered only by two Australians who played the first two tests after the war, Keith Miller and Ernie Toshack. So what's the reaction been to his success?
This has uncovered a whole new layer of Australian culture that I hadn't really factored in before. So basically, if Australia are beating England so badly, they basically turn on themselves because they need some kind of rivalry. So I think in the 1990s, there was a tri-series,
yes,
where England...
Oh, don't talk about this. It was England, Australia and Australia A.
Exactly. Australia went, you're so shit. We're going to play ourselves.
England didn't make the final.
And Australia and Australia A made the final. Right. So what's happened here... And actually, the funniest thing there is Australia A very, very almost beat Australia.
And I think all the Aussies were supporting Australia A from what I've heard about it.
We love an underdog.
So that's what happens. And so instead of having a nice Australia A to call on because they're all either COVID-inflicted, conflicted, playing BBL or something along those lines, they've gone down state lines. Now we talk about the north-south divides in the UK, and I've always thought, that's quite strong. It's got nothing. And Felicia is going to back me up here because the New South Wales Victorian sort of rivalry. I mean, if you only have to take COVID, for example, Western Australia has become this kind of fortress that has basically said that the rest of Australia is absolutely terrible. And that the morning news comes on and he'll compare their COVID stats to other states to show how badly they're doing and put them in a better light. So the New South Wales Victoria is probably the worst of them. And Boland is a Victorian. And most of the sort of older batters that are in an Triple M box are New South Wales. So there's a... I almost feel as though they'd rather have an Englishman do this because it's worse. That's how bad it is.
It is one of the curious delights of cricket, Izzy, that a draw can feel like a victory, despite the fact that England were essentially fairly well beaten for most of the game. I mean, how much do you enjoy, I don't know if it was a particularly heroic rearguard because they were only four down at tee and then nearly messed it up. But it had that glorious moment at the end where Jimmy Anderson, who may never play another test in Australia, he might not play the final test in Hobart. He'll be 43 by the time of the next Ashes tour, facing Steve Smith, who's bowling. He got Jack Leach out, he hadn't taken a test wicket in well over 5 years. And I think if he'd got Anderson out after the heroic persistence of Jimmy Anderson, he's not had a particularly great series in terms of wickets, but Australia basically can't hit him off the square. But if he'd got out to Steve Smith's leg breaks in the last over, I think we might as well have just cancelled cricket forever at that point.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Well, there's Steve Smith in the tiredest of cricketing aphorisms, of course, was picked as a spinner in his test debut. So there was this wonderful narrative arc You could all see the written hacks just poised, ready to come back with this. Alas, it didn't happen. The beauty of a draw isn't so much about the team that pulls it off. It's about denying the joy of the other team. You don't want to watch... I mean, it's all very sweet and lovely, and there's lots of poignant moments between Bord and Anderson being able to hold it off. But what you really want to do is you want to pick out, with your binoculars if you can, each individual Australian fielder and the utter sort of the rage that starts as well, because it's an affront almost. We're not only do we deserve it, but we were born to do this. We were born to beat England, and suddenly this is not happening. That is the beauty of the draw. I mean... Schadenfreude and cricket are a match made in heaven, and I think that comes out in the most beautiful way when there's a draw and denying a team of what should have been a near certain victory, frankly.
Is there concern that this historic rivalry that goes back, you know, to 1877, one of the oldest sporting rivalries in the world, that particularly in Australia, as we talked about earlier on, it's becoming very, very predictable and samey? I mean, do you feel amongst your Australian broadcast colleagues that they're getting bored of it, and that they're now more interested in playing, you know, either against India or just abusing each other's states, as you were saying?
Why would they want to play a team that beats them, which is what India did? No, listen, there's definitely a point where it went, come on, you guys, like, put on a fight. Now we put up a fight and not lost. Australia now want to smash us again. Right. So it's a very easy reset. It's really not that hard. And I mean, that's in the space of 4 days. And normally it's a 4-year cycle. So every time, and the other thing I think Australians really appreciate is that England, every time they come out for the men's Ashes, always give themselves a chance, or more than a chance. I mean, I think Joe Root said his legacy was going to be defined by this series. And I can't believe nobody went to him and went, Joe, have you seen what happened last like 30 years since you've saying this is probably not the best idea, but every single time it's almost encouraged here in Australia. Yeah, you guys are going to come over here and give us a good contest, and then they smash us. Well, first born in Brisbane, frankly. So
yes.
4 years is absolutely sufficient to wipe that slate clean and have it all happen again.
There's been some rather captivating Test cricket elsewhere. Bangladesh last week pulled off one of the most extraordinary victories, possibly the most extraordinary single test victory in the history of the game. Almost 2,500 games of test cricket. They beat New Zealand in New Zealand. New Zealand, the reigning world test champions. Bangladesh, in 21 previous tests in New Zealand, Australia, England and South Africa combined, had lost all 21. They'd lost 15 of those 21 by an innings, and the other six they'd been absolutely hammered in. And they somehow beat New Zealand quite easily. I think it's the greatest shock in test history. Also, South Africa and India poised at one test all after two tightly fought matches. So, I mean, has the Ashes become the least interesting test cricket there is?
Well, Bangladesh overturning that shocking record at least gives England hope in Hobart.
I guess so. That's the kind of positivity we got you on the show for. So exactly. Thank you for bringing that.
The minnows prevailing.
Johnny Bairstow, Felicity Ward from the Bugle Ashes Urncast. In the lead up to the fourth test, it's been said that you're actually out on an archaeological excursion trying to find fossils, but the clay has meant that the bones were much further from the surface. How did you find it?
Yeah, it's been tough. You've got to dig deep. You really have.
Johnny, Andy Zaltzman here from the Bugle Ashes Urncast. Now, I understand part of your motivation for this superb century was a deep-seated hatred of both crop circles and platypuses, and that you were particularly irritated by driving past a farm on the way to the SCG that had crop circles in the shape of a platypus. What did you make of that?
It was a naughty field. I've not seen a field like that before as well.
And Johnny, you've been learning a new language before every test of this series so far. You learned French in the build-up to Brisbane, German before Adelaide, Italian leading up to the MCG game, and you've learnt Basque here in Sydney. Now, Basque is a language that is unrelated to any other. How have you got on with it?
Yeah, it's the hardest one so far, I think.
Andy.
Yes.
Absolutely delightful moment from Usman Khawaja. 2 years away from Test cricket, 6 weeks waiting on the bench. replacing Travis Head because of a positive test, is Usman Khawaja the only man grateful to the Omicron variant in Australia right now?
Well, yes, I think that's quite possible, really. I mean, COVID has done some strange things to cricket. I mean, indirectly, it led to me doing test matches for Test Match Special. So I'm not saying I fully approve of COVID and everything it's done. I'm just saying some people do inadvertently benefit from it. And Usman Khawaja, who, you know, has had a decent test career, averages 40, 800s, done much better in Australia than out of Australia. Mm-hmm. But at 35, you thought, well, he's probably finished. But the sort of new generation of Australians haven't really banked themselves into the team. So he got this chance. And he batted so beautifully. It was sort of old school, silken, classical stroke play.
Yeah, the lactic acid in his legs for all the sweeps, all the slog sweeps.
And it's a series that hasn't had a lot of that. Most of the Australians, Labuschagne's 100 in Adelaide was a kind of ugly, bitty 100. Smith's not been the fluent player he used to be. Warner's had a couple of good innings, but even he is much more restrained than he used to be. And yeah, he did get going quite well in Adelaide. But there's apart from Travis Head's sort of scintillating century in Brisbane, there's not been a lot to really enjoy as a fan of batting.
Yes.
until this game where Bairstow scored a tremendous 100. But he's a rather muscular player. But there's something sort of silken and elegant and liquid about Khawaja. And then we had Crawley, who is, when he doesn't get out in the first 5 minutes, he's absolutely majestic. And even Ian Chappell, the former Australian captain, was very taken with Crawley's stroke play. But anyway, Khawaja, it was a great story. You know, 200, only the third to do so at the SCG. I think from memory it was the ninth time anyone's done it in the Ashes, 200s in one match. So, yeah, it was a tremendous story.
It's incredible. I don't know if you saw the moment where Khawaja's wife, Rachel, was watching the game with their toddler. And, as a parent, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, don't shake the baby. Well, when Uzi got his century, Rachel stood up and held the toddler and shook it like it was the urn itself. Just so excited, and then realised what she was doing, and then stuck the baby on hip, and then did the classic mum side to side rock. It was very, very fun. You know when you're playing with a kid and it's really fun, and then you see their spine bend a little bit further than it should, so you give them a cuddle just in case? Like, oh, we're okay. I don't know if you saw Pat Cummins' behaviour before Uzi's first century.
He got
two fours.
Yeah.
So he got a four, and we're like, all right. Uzi is on like 98 or something, I think, 97, 98. And then Cummins gets another four. Then there's one more ball in the over. And then Cummins hits a single, putting Khawaja again on the non-striker's end. And there was a little bit of him going, I know you're my captain, but what are you doing, mate? You're backing me up. You having a go here? Like, there was a couple of little Paddy Cummins moments. There was that. There was the moment where they weren't sure if there was a nick and they were deciding whether to get a review. And Labuschagne goes, there was a noise. And Paddy gets a bit angry and goes, was it a good noise? I'm like, all right, just a bit. And also, I know it wasn't intentional, but Jack Leach was on a hat-trick. I think Alex Carey got out. And once Usman was out, they should have just brought it in. But he's like, nah, get the next player out there. He got out for a duck and Paddy goes, all right, everyone in. Let's not turn this into a shit show. Usman Khawaja, an absolute honour and a privilege to watch you get those amazing centuries. Felicity Ward from the Ashes Urncast, amazing performance. And how you get yourself into the mindset to play is that you like to avoid baking bread. What do you say to yourself?
If it doesn't happen, it's all right. I actually don't have anything to prove.
Andy, something that's been bothering me since I was a teenager, I would say, is there are things that I do not know about being a man. And this sounds very sexist.
Okay. Let me just say that there's a hell of a lot of things that I don't know about being a man as well. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to help out.
I've got two main things. One thing that has always baffled me is how men remember things about sport. Now, yes, it may be a substitute for exploring their internal emotional landscape.
Yes, it is that, yeah.
It is that. Okay, yeah, yeah. Because I can barely remember which day Usman got centuries in this test. And it was two out of the 5 days, and I can't remember which ones. Whereas you can talk about a test from 1976 where Bangladesh were playing Zimbabwe.
Well, no. I can't do that because neither of them had become test nations at that point, Felicity.
But I was waiting for this. Yeah. That was a trick question.
Okay, good.
And I was going to say, how do you remember things? How do you keep remembering things? Because I got nothing. Even before I had a kid, I was useless. And it seems like men, on the whole, have a huge part of their memory committed to sports and sports events and sporting moments that if they can't bring them up, they are humiliated and shamed.
Yes. Well, I mean, how? I don't know. I mean, it's a curse as much as a gift, to be honest. But, you know, it's... something that I guess I can only thank Almighty Zeus for bestowing on me the ability to remember 1920s batting averages and the like. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, there's times when I'm in the fortunate position of having monetized me wasting my brain on sport.
Mm.
So, you know, it's worked out all right for me. But, you know, for the majority of my life, it was purely a recreational waste of a brain rather than a professionally endorsed waste of a brain. But in terms of why that is the case,
that's the question.
I don't know if it goes back, you know, to the early thinking of the evolution of humanity and, you know, man as the hunter-gatherer. If, you know, you needed to know the stats on what dinosaurs had particularly spiky teeth, or, you know, how saber a tiger's tooth had to be before you had to really worry about it. You know, your mammoth stats, your poisonous berry stats were all absolutely critical. And I guess, you know, that as we move beyond that, we needed an outlet for that part of the male brain, and sports stats finally jumped into the breach.
It's absolutely fascinating to me because there isn't a comedian that I know that doesn't have some kind of, like, mastermind egghead area in their brain committed to, if they ever got called up, they'd have a specialist subject, which would be a team of a sport, sometimes multiple.
Yeah.
And they can just answer anything, and that's just always available to them. My follow-up question in Ask a Man is, we've discussed Joe Root's undercarriage and how many times he was hit in the undercarriage and how painful it is for men when that happens. And yet, at the same time, men absolutely love to slide. They love to slide in sport, face down across the line, in the outfield towards the boundary, sliding. How do you not hurt your junk? How do you not crunch the junk in those situations? Like, why is a ball painful but a flattening with full body weight fine?
Well, that's something I've never really thought about. I mean, I guess that, again, that's evolution, isn't it? That obviously,
I don't know.
When you slide,
why else would I ask?
Well, because, you know, sliding obviously was a very good means of evading the dinosaurs. Going back to this, you know, obviously the human dinosaur rivalry that was documented in so many great films. That, you know, if you could slide under a triceratops, then you could easily escape it. So
yeah, I know
then
what sliding does.
Well, yeah, but so then obviously the male junk, as you correctly call it, named after, I believe, Albert Junkovich, the Czech scientist who discovered the testicles.
He actually couldn't get into Australia, funny enough, on a visa.
In the 19th century. So when you slide, obviously evolution has meant that I assume it kind of retracts
right
into, you know, like an aeroplane's wheels. That's, you know, 'cause aeroplane wheels are,
yeah.
I mean, they are the testicles of the aeroplane. Have you ever seen aeroplanes mate? But look, it doesn't matter.
No.
So the slide is an evolutionary escape mechanism, whereas the cricket ball hitting you in the nuts, there was no place for that in evolution. I mean, the worst you get was an apple falling out of a tree, and that was generally a headshot rather than a nutshot. So,
yeah. Okay.
So I guess that probably answers your question.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up.
Good, yep. Stand back, it's a stat whack. Well, a great escape for England. The ninth time that they've managed to draw a test with their last pair at the crease. Most of them have been quite recent. So I think seven in the last 25 years, only two before that. However, it was a game largely dominated by Australia. Here's something. In both innings, Felicity, five of their top six reached 20. So 10 innings in the top six of 20 or more in the match. And that is the first time Australia have done that against England since 1981,
wow.
Would you believe, in an Ashes test. And England have only done it twice since then. So it was quite a rare achievement. And it showed, you know, Australia's not... You look at the numbers for the series. You take out Khawaja's brilliant match here. No one's really having a dominant series even with the ball. They've all sort of chipped in. It's been a very good team effort without any individualsness.
Yeah, heaps of them have got shit loads, haven't they?
Yeah. And the ones who've done amazingly individually, Khawaja and Boland, have only done so in, one and two matches respectively. Something to look forward to in the final test. This was a stat. I had a bit of a hunch about this, and I thought I'd check it. It seems to me that a lot of England careers end in the final tests in Australia, particularly when England lose. And I looked at the stats for this, and there has only ever been one Ashes series in Australia that England have lost that has not brought the end of someone's test career. And that was 1950-51. And the only reason that wasn't the end of players' careers was because they then went straight to New Zealand, as they used to after Ashes stories, and played a couple of tests there. And Doug Wright never played after that series. So, you know, had they not gone to New Zealand, that series would have had the end of someone's career. But every other losing campaign in Australia, the final test has brought the end of at least one England player's career, generally more in the last eight that they've had in this era since 1990. A total of 17 players in those eight previous final tests have never played for England again.
And actually, what they do is they just don't let them back on the plane. They just have to live in Australia for the rest of their natural life.
So even though they've been thrashed in this route, I don't know that this will necessarily be the case. They're talking about Sam Billings replacing Butler, who's flown home with a busted finger, playing as wicketkeeper. It's possible that could be a one-off, but, you know, if he does well, he might get another go. But I'm not sure there's going to be anyone else. So maybe we will break that sequence.
Yeah, maybe. It seems such a brutal way to say goodbye. Why would you want to finish in Australia in the Ashes losing?
Well, they're generally not voluntary. That's the thing. It's Zach Crawley. There's so much hope invested in Zach Crawley, partly because a lot of England players who've come in recently have not been the best to watch, particularly at the top of the order. Sibley, Burns, let's say awkward players. Nothing to inspire the lyrical soul of the cricket writer. Zach Crawley, on the other hand, when he's playing well, plays majestic shots. Everyone sort of really wants him to do well, but since he made 267 against Pakistan in August 2020, he has had one of the worst runs any specialist test batsman has had. His 2021 average, about, I think, 10 or 11, was one of the worst calendar years of a test batsman in the history of the game. But he played beautifully in the second innings of the city, made 77, and it was got up a really excellent yorker by Cameron Green. And it was quite interesting that the bowlers on our commentary team thought it was an accidental yorker. See, I saw and I thought, oh, that's a brilliant piece of bowling. And then our expert pundit said, oh, he didn't mean that. And obviously they would know a lot more than me, having bowled fast in test matches. But I don't know whether, you know, who knows? We'll have to ask. I don't know if Cameron Green's expressed. I guess you couldn't even trust him if he said, yeah, I definitely meant it. But anyway, so Crawley scored 77 of the first 100. And the data's not totally complete, but it covers most of the tests England have played. Only once has an England batsman scored more than 77 of England's first 100 runs of an innings. That was Graham Gooch in a test in India in the 1981-82
series.
And Haseeb Hameed, by contrast, really struggling. He's had six single-figure scores in a row. Before this time last year, Felicity, there'd only been two instances in England's test history of top three batters having six or more single-figure scores in a row. One was a chap called George Ulyett in the 1880s. He was a fairly dominant figure in England's early test history. But he had a couple of innings lower down the order where he did reach double figures in amongst that sequence of top three innings. And then there was Bill Athey in the 1980s, And his was spread over 6 years, so he had a long period out of the side.
How cruel.
So essentially, we'd never had a top three player have six consecutive innings in single figures, dismissals in single figures in a row, without having a massive career break. And it's since happened three times. Sibley, five innings against India and the first innings against New Zealand. Crawley, again, the end of the India series and the first three innings against New Zealand last summer. And now Hamid in the Ashes. And it just sort of highlights how extraordinarily difficult England's young batters have found it over the last year or so.
How do you change that?
Well, I don't know, really. And this is the problem, because they'd be left out and they'd go back to county cricket and they'd work on their games. But county cricket, as has been much discussed, isn't really providing that learning experience anymore. So I don't think anyone knows that. Yeah. And one final stat about Johnny Bairstow's 100. He came in at 36 for four. He's the 52nd visiting player batting at six or lower to make 100 in Australia. And none of the previous 51 have come in with a score lower than 36. Well, that concludes this week's Bugle Ashes Urncast after that triumphant non-triumph for England, which has given, I think, the series a bit of a boost, because it had been so grimly one-sided and really joyless for England, with all the, you know, the context and the difficulties of being a touring side in the time of COVID, and the fact that literally no one had had a good series. Yeah. But at least now they've had a couple of individual moments. They've had a team moment where they avoided defeat with a decent rear guard on the final. Let's set it up for Hobart, the first ever Ashes test Hobart. It's very exciting to be here. I've never been to Hobart before. Just landed this afternoon. It looks like a lovely place. I'm looking forward to exploring it a bit in the days before the test. And a new Ashes venue in Australia. The last time there was a new Ashes venue in Australia was there was a new stadium in Perth, but the last time there was a new city was Perth, I think, in about 1970, and then Brisbane in 28-9, and the first game at the Gabba in Brisbane was 32-3. So this is a little moment of Ashes history that has been brought about by the fact that Perth couldn't host this final test. It's great to be here. What do you want from this final? I mean, I think really all I want another decent game. I want England not to crumble. I don't really mind if they lose, as long as they kind of play well and aren't just, if they don't capitulate as they have
If they don't perish,
certainly did in Melbourne. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I want too. I'm looking for a draw. I don't even mind an England win. Don't even mind it. It's been such a grueling, grueling couple of months for these England players. If they could live with a win, then maybe Joe Root won't escape to the Himalayas for the next 8 years of his life to become a monk. Because that is a sadness that I haven't seen in quite a long time that was in his eyes.
Yeah.
May I give my utmost love to the people of Hobart. It is a brilliant island. It has some of the best produce in the world. If you've got time, get down to Bruny Island. Have some triple cream brie from, I think, Cape Island it is. It's just... Hobart is so beautiful, and the whole of Tasmania is just gorgeous. It's like a tiny, tiny Tasmania. I love it. Big fan of Hobart, and also one of the most beautiful theatres in Australia. So I'm very excited for you, Andy. Mm-hmm. And I'm also excited because if this never happens again, you were there for the one and only time that the Ashes got played at Hobart. And if for nothing else, that is what you deserve. You deserve a once in a lifetime moment after the shit you've eaten for 6 weeks.
Well, when you say that, I've still been in Australia following the Ashes and pursuing my childhood dreams. It's not been that bad, despite the various inconveniences. We will be back to report exclusively. I think we're the only media outlet covering the Hobart test here on the Bugle Ashes Urncast, following the final test and England's glory. I think away wins count triple, so they could still draw the series.
I think so.
We will tell you all about this after the final test. Felicity, as always, enormous thanks to Isabel Westbury for joining us. There will be a regular Bugle this week as well, with Alice Fraser and a new Bugler, James Colley, who were supposed to be doing the live show in Sydney that sadly got cancelled, but we'll be recording that tomorrow, so do tune into that as well. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye. I'm full of panettone.
You can listen to other programmes from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.